Yeah, the last verse, verse 48 of the third chapter, the Leviticus Covenant. We're going to start on the last verse, and then we'll go back and forth a little bit from the last three verses, because they're together anyway, but we'll look at this last thing first, otherwise we'll never get to it. Know how that is. So.
Om Padram Karne Vishnu Namadevaha Bhadram Pashe Mapshadhiryajatraha Stirayangaihi Shtushtavagum Sastanubihi Yashema Devahi Tanyadayuhu Swastina Indra Vyuddashravaha Swastina Pusha Vishwedaha Swastina Starakshu Arishtanehi Swastino Brahaspatir Tadatu. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Okay. Chapter 3 of Bible for Cutting Up, verse 48. We'll start the same.
Nakaschit jayate jivaha
Sambhavosya navidyate
Sambhavosya navidyate
Etat tat uttamam satyam
Etat tat uttamam satyam
Yatra kinchit na jayate
Yatra kinchit na jayate
Na kaschit jayate jivaha Sambhavaha asya navidyate Etat tad uttamam satyam Yatra kinchit na jayate Shankar gives an introduction to this verse, which leads into it. So I'll talk about the intro first, and then lead it into the verse and try to translate the verse. Up to this point, especially in these last five or six verses, he's been talking about different upayas. Upayas means different means that we use for gaining this knowledge. And then he talked about the four pratibandhakas to meditation, the things that get in the way of your meditative process, sort of totally withdrawing the activities of the mind just to resolve into your own being. So he talked about laya, you can go to sleep and fall asleep, right? He talked about vikshepa, where your mind gets totally distracted by raga dvesha, by your likes and your dislikes. He talked about kashayas. Kashayas are those things that are really rising up from the unconscious that give kind of a dullness. You're not asleep, but you're also, your mind isn't absorbed. There's no vikshepa, really. There's no agitation. You're not asleep, and you're also not absorbed. So you're in this liminal, this borderline liminal space that's a little dull and boring. It's called kashaya. So how to deal with those things. The fourth one was sukha. Sukha means that pleasure you get is your mind is not being distracted. It's not falling asleep. It's not being distracted, the kashayas are resolved for the moment anyway. You know? And you're not getting pulled away by the sukha. I mean your mind's not getting pulled away, it's going in. At that time the sukha starts to come in the mind. And that can be a distraction where then your mind starts focusing on the pleasure itself. You know? And so that's a distraction because now what's happening is as that absorption is coming and the mind becomes more and more, has more and more shanti, right? More and more shanti is there. The ananda reflects your own nature really is reflecting in its own way in the mind, and that's very pleasurable. And so now you can focus on that pleasure as though that is the end goal. That pleasurable mind, that mind that's enjoying happiness or fullness or bliss, your mind starts to circle around that. But the problem with that is that that bliss is born of a vritti, of a thought modification. It's a shanta vritti, and it's very pleasurable, right? And it can be highly blissful even, but you're focusing on the mind, the antakarana, a state of mind, what we call an antakarana vritti. And antakarana vrittis, these thought modifications, by their nature, come and go. And so if you are not taught to notice and recognize that for what it is, then the mind can get lost there. And then you become distracted and you're focused on the shanta vritti, on the ananda. And then, of course, the ananda goes away. Right? Because now you've externalized, and so the mind is no longer resolving, because your mind is starting to work around that. And then you think, I have to get that again. I just lost the Atma. I just lost myself. This is a common mistake. Common mistake. So he's gone through, up to this time, all of these upayas and teaching you how to contemplate, teaching you about vipassana, about meditation, meditative techniques. Also, using the world and different kinds of drishtantas, illustrations, to make you recognize the nature of your being, of the conscious being, to this world. Like, say, for instance, clay pot or golden chain, you know? These are only upayas. Say I'm talking all about the relationship between the pot to the clay, and your mind stays on the clay pot, right? These upayas means all of these means, are being used to point to something else. They're not an end goal in themselves. Now this can be really, really true of yoga, and even in some cases, some forms of Buddhism or other teachings also, where the means is the end. Like, say, for instance, if you think that by controlling your mind, you will eventually achieve a controlled mind, mano nigraha. He was talking earlier, it's called mano nigraha, the control of the mind. So say you practice a variety of techniques to reach this mano nigraha, this control of the mind. Now you've accomplished it. So now the question is the accomplishment of the control of the mind the end goal? So the attainment of the upaya, the attainment of the means, is the end. And so here, with this verse, what he's saying and how Shankara leads up to this, is that all of these means, all of these teaching methodologies, all of these ways of gaining antakarana shuddhi. So think of it like this. Karma yoga. We practice karma yoga in order to gain a particular attitude. A particular attitude that gives shanti to the mind and non-resistance to Ishvara. So I can accept my prarabdha karma. So I gain these type of attitudes, and so now I've gained the attitude. Right? Mm. Is that the end goal? Mm. Is the gain of that shanti the end goal? And you say, no. None of these. All of them, exist within Maya. Right? All of these exist within duality. All of these things, so you're gaining skill, kaushalam, you're gaining skill with the Maya upadis. Yeah? Skill in terms of a healthy body, a healthy nadis, you know, the nervous system, you know, a mind that you can absorb, a mind with which you can practice samadhi. Asanas where you can hold your posture for an hour, which means that you have successfully mastered that particular asana. You know, so all of these things, are they an end in themselves? So, because he's just done all of these teachings, teaching about mano nigraha, the control of the mind, and all of these meditative techniques and pasanas and things like that, and also used a lot of illustrations and drishtantas, you know, to talk about the nature of the world. But are any of those things what we're really talking about? And so he says, now he says, those things are simply upayas. They are means for the pratipati, means the means to help you gain the knowledge of the self. They themselves are not the knowledge of the self. They help you to gain that knowledge, to recognize. So, what's so interesting here is you can just see in this, in our world, right, every one of my experiences, every one of my mental states, from the most awful to the most sublime, every experience that I have in this world exists within duality. Now, what that means is that every single experience that I have, without exception, you know, comes into being and goes out of being. Right? Because the experience isn't always with you. You have the experience goes. For everything, every experience for which that is the case, and in fact, when we use the word experience, that is the case, because that's how we're using the word experience. An experience by nature comes and goes. If the experience comes and goes, it can't be you. It's impossible by a very important logic called anvayavyatireka. That logic goes, when this is, that is. When this is not, that still is. So, now like this. Let me do the positive one. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. That is a functioning anvayavyatireka, where the positive assertion and the negative are both true. When the sun is, the day is. When the sun is down, the day is gone. The day is not there. So both positively and negatively, there's a relationship. Because yeah, those two things have something to do with each other. So say if I had a proper anvayavyatireka in terms of my experience, in terms of the experience being myself, I would say, when this experience is, I am. When this experience is not, I am not. Okay. The problem is a huge problem. Because you actually cannot experience your non-being. Right? It's not possible to experience. In fact, for you, for all of us, and in fact, anything that you can dismiss is not you. Any experience, including knowership, anything that you cannot, and that you can dismiss, is not going to be you. So look at what this amounts to in terms of your own viveka, your own discrimination. When this thought is, I am. When this thought is gone, I still am. It's a thought flow. And this, it may sound like an obvious thing. It's not obvious because you take yourself to be your thoughts. When this emotion is, I am. When this emotion is gone, I still am. Now, I always have that experience. I know that. Like if I say that to you right now, what can you say? No, that's not true. Well, you know it is true. There's no way to deny it. Even when you're sitting, when you do a contemplation, to make that viveka, that discrimination, that distinction between my own being, you know, and the thoughts coming and going, like we did just now, the thoughts coming and going, the emotions coming and going, the images coming and going, what you experience at that time is something that I would say should be very obvious to you, that you still remain, you know? But we have to slow everything down and then turn our attention to that fact, that in fact, in my experience, there is something that is never shifting or changing in any way. And it really doesn't make any difference at all what the experience is. The presence or absence of any experience doesn't change that self-abiding nature of my own presence. And so that self-abiding nature, just the conscious being that I am, when I start to focus in on that and recognize actually in the totality of my experience, when I include the subject, right, there's me, the conscious being, and then all of this activity going on, that activity is going on within me who is not doing anything. So now if you start asking yourself in meditation, for instance, well, am I doing anything? Am I knowing anything as a knower? You say, no, I'm not performing a verbal action of knowing. It's just that in my presence, everything is known. But you can't say, like I joked in the meditation, here comes a thought, I better know it. Let me do an action. Let me know this thought. You know? Let me know this emotion. Let me be aware of this. There's no such thing. There's no activity. There's only awareness in which all of these things are arising, and that awareness, which is my being, is not something that I can change or that I can get behind to illumine. I can't get behind me, right? I can't illumine me as though there's somebody that needs to illumine me. I can't make myself become something else. Now, with your thoughts, you can change your thoughts, right? Like you can say, and we do this for Antakarana Shuddhi, I'm not going to think in this direction. This doesn't lead to any positive result. Let me not go, let me not follow that line. Let me not think about this. Let me stop. Stop. You know? Don't go there. You know? Or let's think about this. Are these emotions are painful? Let me just accept them. I am playing with my mind. I am doing things with it and to it. But now try to do that to your own being. What if you were to say to the me, the conscious being, let me not be conscious anymore. You know? Or let me shut it down. Let me direct my attention elsewhere. You know? Absolutely nothing happens. There's nothing you can do. You can't. Let me ramp up the light a little bit more to make it shine a little bit brighter. Or let me turn it down. Nothing happens except conscious being that you are is illuminating this mind that's thinking all these thoughts. But nothing is happening to you. You yourself simply are. Then you ask, okay, like right now, this me, the self that you are you doing anything? Your mind is doing something, your body's doing something, but your own me, this me that makes you you, are you doing anything? Can you make yourself do anything? Do you want to do anything? Do you want this me, the self that you are, to change, to be different? Do you want it to? These are all good questions to ask in meditation. I'm just giving you a few to play with. Do you think this me, yourself, do you want it to mature? Do you want it to become bigger, better? And if you know this me that I'm talking about, you'll just say no. There's no way to improve it. There's no way to do anything to it. Nor do you want to. Your mind, like I can say, no, I want my mind to be more compassionate. Or I want my mind to, you know, enjoy more shanti. Or I would like to do this, or I'd like my body to lose some weight. Whatever, you can have all those kind of thoughts. They're all doable. But that realm does not apply to your being. And can you make this being, like you can your mind, you can make your mind change, you can manipulate your mind, you can do things with it, and you can send it in bad directions and in good directions. So many things you can do with your body, also with your breath. You can even work with your unconscious by getting into dialogue with the unconscious and bringing things into consciousness. Mm. A lot of things you can do. Mm. But the me, is what we call asanga. You can't touch it. There's It is the self and present to everything, but try to touch it and change it. You say, no, it's not possible. And so now in this verse, this final verse of this section, Shankara opens it by talking about this, that everything that Gaudapada has been talking about, meditation, about controlling the mind, about talking about the nature of this universe and the jiva's relationship in the universe, all of that is useful, but it's all simply a means to point to something else. It is not an end in itself. That's the critical thing to know, because we can take these upayas to be ends in themselves, you know, and then we're on a real treadmill, right? Because there's nothing in samsara that's an end in itself, because everything in samsara comes to an end, right? So it's endless change. It's not going, there's no way to stop it, right? There's no end game here. There's just continual change. That's the very nature of duality. And so now he says, so he introduces that in this verse. So he says, all of these things that have come before are simply upayas to point out the nature of your being as pointers, right? Paramartha satyam tu, whereas what is the absolute reality that all of these things are being used to point to is this. And he says, nakaschit jayate jivaha. He says, no jiva has ever been born. Nakaschit means never. Nakaschit jayate jivaha. A jiva, you consider yourself a jiva, we're all jivas, then there's the universe, and then there's Ishwara. Mm-hmm. So you think, I'm a jiva, I have been born, right? I've been transmigrating. I've taken birth after birth after birth after birth. So I, this jiva, I have been born. No one has ever been born. No jiva has ever been born. Then he says, sambhavaha asya navidyate. This atma, first part, this self, the conscious being, how could it have taken birth? If it had taken birth, then itself is existing within duality and is subject to coming and going. It's subject to change. And so then this self itself, the self that you are, is mitya. Your very self is mitya. Mitya means it comes into being and goes out of being. Now, it's true that this body comes into being and out of being. It's true that the sukshma sharira, these things, subtle body, all exist within this creation, within duality. They're constantly changing. They're constantly going through, just like your mind is continually changing. Try to stop it. It won't stop. Try to stop the body from changing. It's not going to stop. It's not its nature. And so body after body after body has been born. You've been in one place and then in another place and then another place and then another place. So of course the jiva has been born. The jiva has never been born. Who is the jiva? Who is the jiva really? In fact, there really is no jiva. The jiva, when we say jiva, jiva is the atma, Brahman, the conscious being, that is changeless, that is the sarva-bhuta shavanam, the sarva-atma, the atma of all beings, the very self of Ishwara. This atma, your being, which you now that we've seen in meditation and doing all of this viveka, you recognize your own being as somebody you can't touch. It's a somebody you can't touch. You can't make yourself change. That's because it has never changed. What makes you think that you are a jiva, I'm different from you, from you, from you, is the avidya, the mind's avidya, ignorance of your own being. Now, why? Because this is the situation. The mind, this is the satya mitya situation. The mind being mitya, right? It is you. It is the Atma. It's not mistaken there. It is the Atman. And so the mind, of course, is going to say, I am the conscious being. It's like the pot saying, I'm the clay. It is the clay. Clay pot, pot says, I'm the clay. It is totally the clay. There's nothing there but clay. But here, this mind says, I am the conscious being. I am the Atman. I'm to be. I am the self, right? I'm the self. It says, I am the self. That's what it thinks. And that's when it is happy, I am happy. When it is sad, I am sad. Because it has the self, the Atma, for its being. It just doesn't realize the satya-mitya relationship, that the mind is totally me, but I am totally free of the mind. Now, in contemplation, what do we see? The mind enjoys me completely, but I am changeless. I am the changeless, untouchable being that is not objectifiable, that I can't get behind, I can't change it, I can't make it light up any more than it is, I can't make it be any different than it is, I can't cover it over. I'm always exactly the same, and all change takes place within me without touching me at all. I haven't been born. Everything is being coming into being and going out of being. All of my experience is nothing but change, birth and death. We talk about the birth and death of this body, but every moment is a birth and death. It's the birth of this moment, is the death of the prior moment. So there is nothing but birth and death, continual birth and death. But for me, there's never any change. That's why I don't freak out. That's why I don't disappear. How can I even be here? The last moment is gone. How can I even be here? Everything about me is gone, except for the Atman, the self, me. And me is never gone. And so I am actually the timeless nitya, the timeless, changeless, untouchable asanga being, which is the very adhishtana, the very truth of all of my experience. So that's what I have to see, that in fact, I have never been born, nor can I be born, because I'm not an object within time to qualify for birth. I don't qualify. To qualify for birth, I have to exist within the creation and be subject to time and change. But time and change takes place in me. I'm the constant. Now, that's a fact for you to recognize in your own experience. That's why we do contemplation and meditation, and why the unfoldment takes place in a way to kind of peel off the maya. Peel off the upadis, the body and the mind and the sense organs and the moods and all of the things that are changing, to make you recognize, wait, I'm always there in exactly the same way. That's why Gaudapada and his way, he using the meditation, he just withdraws all of the maya, makes it just resolve, become totally quiet, dysfunctional, totally withdraws the whole thing so it's not active, and then what is left? Whenever nothing's active, what is left? Brahman. Just my being without any of this activity, maya activity taking place. He does that so you can see, so you can recognize yourself without any dress. Contemplation is helpful to withdraw the experience of the upadis, of the conditioning adjuncts, so that you can recognize yourself without them, because the mind is so used to this mutual superimposition where the mind just naturally takes itself to be, right, the experience. And why shouldn't it? Because I am always there. It does not have to discern me. I'm the given. I'm the water for the fish. Right? It doesn't need any discernment, because whatever it is doing, I'm there. As the stable substratum, so stable, I'm invisible because I'm totally taken for granted. It only distinguishes its differing thoughts, its differing emotions, its differing experiences. This experience is different than this experience. It doesn't notice me, who is the constant, no matter what the experience. And so now we have to do this depth viveka, this, you know, this depth discrimination instead of one thought different from the other, different from the other, one experience different from the other. Now my experiences are a little bit more mature than they used to be. My mind is a little bit more mature and all of this. This is differentiation experiences. But I'm there as the Sakshi, as the one who is the constant. And this is the one that has to be discerned. Now, has that one been born? It's not subject to change. It can't be born. So there is no transmigrating jiva. Right? There's the transmigrating upadis. There's the subtle body that is, again, subtle body belongs to duality. It's transmigrating. It has a mind, the sattva, that reflects consciousness. That sattva mind is transmigrating. Wherever the sattva mind, sattva means it reflects consciousness. Wherever the sattva mind goes, I am. I'm not going anywhere. It's like if I move a pot from point A, here's the pot. I move the pot from point A to point B. From the pot's viewpoint, its pot space has moved. It's moved from this point. Now here the pot space, you know, it's being pulled along, ripping through the space, you know, to over here. No, that's not what's happening. Space just simply is. Nothing happens. Space isn't moving. So that illustration is just to help you recognize you're not moving. You're not walking. You're not talking. You know, you're not transmigrating. Transmigration takes place in you. You are the non-dual conscious being that never does anything. So you're, and you think, well, I never do anything? Oh no. But you know what? The whole universe is an expression of you. Your being need not do anything. Your being, this whole universe is an expression of your being. Your being is whole and complete. It has no need to do anything. And so now, if you just focus on this me, the self that you are, you ask yourself, do I need to do something? Do you want it to do something? What do you want it to do? It doesn't need to do anything. It's complete and whole in itself. As you are, the self can't be improved upon. It's complete. You know? And so I would say, the idea of your being having to do something is inapplicable. It doesn't, the question doesn't come up. It's kind of like asking yourself, say you're in meditation, you're just being with your own being, and then I ask you, okay, what color are you? What color is awareness? Awareness is not a color, it doesn't apply. Okay. How tall are you? Awareness doesn't have anything to do with height. Are you fat or are you thin? What color are you? How big are you? Are you a man or a woman? Let me see. These words don't apply. These words exist within duality. They don't touch you. They don't touch you. They have nothing to do with you. They don't apply. But to say, well, okay, they don't apply. No, I want you to see that they don't apply. Just by being with yourself, do they apply or not? They have nothing to do with that. And so this self that you are, this other thing is, can you get rid of yourself? If you've noticed who you are, this me, you can never get rid of it. You don't want to get rid of it, and there's no need to get rid of it. But you can't. Even if you were to want to, which there's no way for you to want to. Because it's you. It's your being. It's like committing suicide or something. You can't even think about it. You can think about getting rid of pain, fear, you know, torture, bad habits. You can think about getting rid of those things. But not your being, not who you are. There's nothing more sacred than that. There's nothing more beloved. There's nothing more dear. Say you have fear of death. Everybody has their own fear of death, which they're either blocking out in one way or another. No, I don't have any fear of death. Swamiji always makes fun of that. I have no fear of death. As long as I don't have to die right now. Do you have, you don't have any fear? I have no fear of death. Okay, let's go. Not now. I have no fear of death, but not now.
Wait a second.
Yeah, right tomorrow. Yeah. Why not now? Why not now?
Fear.
Yeah. Because I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. So, another thing to understand about that, was so powerful about that, is that if life was hell, I don't think you'd have a fear of death. It would be like, hurry. Mm-hmm. If your being was a hell being, if we could imagine such a thing, just a dark, evil creature, devoid of love, that's the worst. If your nature was devoid of love, it would be so cold, freezing, cold. Yeah. Then there's nobody to want to continue there. But that is not the case. That's not our case. It's nobody's case. Not even the devil's case. Because at the core is this beloved me. You are the beloved. There's nothing that is more dear to you than your being. So you can want to get rid of all obstructions, all things that hurt you, all things that are painful, all limitations. All those limitations belong to the upadis. We want to get rid of those. We don't want to get rid of me. And you don't want to die. The part of liberation is when you... I mean, there's so many aspects to liberation, because we can talk about it from so many different standpoints, but one thing is the recognition is that, in fact, that which is most dear to you cannot ever die. And that one who is here right now has never been born, in fact. You have never been born because you're not subject to time. So the time exists in Maya. It's like, think of when you have a dream. The time comes with a dream, and it goes with a dream. The time and space and duality belong to the creation. They don't belong to the self. The self is free of time. And so there is no possibility of you ever having been born. So here he says, this, what you consider this jiva, there's no, the jiva has never been born because in fact the jiva is self. And then he says, sambhavaha asyana vidyate, there is no cause. There is no cause for this jiva. If there was a cause for it, right, then there's a prior condition. But there's no source or cause for the jiva. The jiva has never been born because the jiva is the Atma. The Atma itself doesn't have a prior condition. There's nothing that the Atma has come from. If the Atma has come from somewhere, then the Atma exists within time. It exists within change. But the self is absolutely changeless. There's no prior condition. See what I mean? The Atma has not been born from the grand Atma, grandma or something, the mother Atma. There's no one behind me. There's no causal condition. So he says, sambhavaha asyena vidyate. It has no source from which it has come. And then he says, etat uttamam satyam. This is the absolute truth. This is what is true. It is this that is true. Everything else, and he says, that which is true, this is the uttamam, the absolute satyam, truth. What? Yatra, where? Kinchit na jayate, where nothing has ever been born. That is the absolute truth for the Atma. There has never been any birth. It itself has not been born. It has not come from something. Nor can it go into something. It is the very adhishtana, the very conscious being, from which this whole Maya has come and resolves back into. But it itself is not subject to time or space. It's not subject, because time and space belong to the projection, to the creation. It's free of time and space. So then you ask, free of time and space, how long has it been there? It's an irrelevant question. How long has the Atma been there? Yep, it's free of time. So that means it is the presence of the present. Right? It has no time. It's not growing old, growing infinitely old. It'd be so old now. But that means that time, it's within time. It's free of time. How big is it? This is another thing that can be very confusing, because you think, I am the self of all beings. I must be huge. You know, because I'm the self of all beings. I'm the self of Ishwar. Ishwar is infinite. We can't even imagine the size of this infinite manifest creation. We think from our position that it's unimaginably big. But just imagine what the cell in my little toe thinks about me. Infinitely big. So these concepts are totally relative. They don't really mean much. Whether it's infinite in size or tiny in size, or, you have no idea what that means. From your standpoint, it's inconceivable what it is. From Ishwar's standpoint, it's just his body. That's all. It's just his upadi. And he doesn't think, I'm infinitely big or I'm infinitely small. Just who I am. You don't think I'm big or I'm small. If you think I'm big, it's in reference to the person who's only 5'6" and you're 6 feet. You know what I mean? Or the person who weighs 130 and you weigh 250. It's so relative. Like Swamiji will joke about this word big, the difference between a big mountain and a big mosquito. Mm-hmm. Right? It's so relative. Okay, so for Ishwara, you know, if I am the self of Ishwara, I must be huge. But you're free of space. So you're not about huge or small. You're not small, you're not huge. You see what I mean? To really understand, it's good to use your imagination. Like if I ask you right now, okay, imagine a universe. Because you've studied science enough to have some sort of beautiful imagination of the universe. Now, has your size changed when you've imagined that? No. The time and space exist within the imagination. They come with the imagination, they go with the imagination. Do you see that? You have an imagination, the time, space, size belong there. You withdraw the imagination, the time and space that were part of the imagination is withdrawn. You have nothing to do with time and space. So that being so, how big are you? How small are you? It's totally irrelevant. You're not big, you're not small. You're the only thing that is there. It has nothing to do, you have nothing to do with dimension. But if time and space and all the things that exist within the creation come along with that manifestation, then your being is simply non-dual. There's no conceptualization of size at all. You don't have a right size, right side or a left side or a top or a bottom. One person described your being as like an infinite point, which is kind of interesting, because a point has no size. Okay? But that's all there is. You know? So, but if you think of yourself, what do you think? If you think of yourself as an infinite point, and that's quite mega. But when you just kind of focus in just on your own presence and you ask these questions, the irrelevancy that you see is important. That no, the question doesn't apply to you. Mm-hmm. And so he says, your being, the being that you are, that is what is true. It is free of time and space. You have never been born. There's not another source from which you have come. You are the very non-dual being which has this Maya, this incredible Maya, as part of its nature. Then there should be two. There should be me and this incredible Maya. No, because this Maya that we experience on every level has no independent being of its own, because it comes into being and goes out of being continually. There's no being there. Its being is the non-dual being of me. I am its being. There's only one being. So if Maya had its own being, then Maya has its own thing going, and then there's me. You know, that is something else. But that's not true. You don't say there's me and my dream as though the dream has some independent existence apart from me. or me and my thoughts, and so the thoughts themselves, the thought stuff, has a reality independent of me. And we have these drishtantas like good old clay pot and rope snake. The pot is there, it's not there. It's there, it's not there. That's right. It's there, but it's not there. It's not really there. There it is. Snake is not there, but there it is. But there's no independent snake. The snake is only the rope, but there it is. That's Maya. That's what we mean. It has no independent being, but there it is. Here this creation is, but upon any kind of analysis, no, there's nothing here. Nothing here that you can find. Everything here comes into being and goes out of being. Everything here is infinitely divisible. You can't find a thing here. That's why Swamiji says it's just names within names within names within names within names within names of Brahman. Because the only thing here is a non-dual conscious being, which is Brahman, which is my own self. That's the ultimate reality. All of these upayas, all of these teaching methodologies, these ways of meditating, ways of being to bring about an antakarana shuddhi, or a quiet mind that can be available for this knowledge, right? Those are all devices to help you gain knowledge of the non-dual reality of yourself. But they themselves exist in Maya as long as, well, as everything else. Mm-hmm. This is the truth. So he stops there. Om Swasti Prajapyah Paripalyantam Nyayena Margena Mahinmahishah Go Brahmane Vyashivamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parajanyah Prativi Sasti Shalini Desho Yamsho Parahitah Vāmanāsantu nirbhayāha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayāha Sarve bhadrāni bhashyantu Mā kaschit dukkha bhāk bhavet Asato mā sadgamaya Tamaso mā jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amagrangamaya Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Arihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha
Hare. You know, this idea of Brahman being unborn, mm-hmm. that means that it's timeless, right? Because to have a birth, there has to be time to it.
Right, yeah, it has to all be taking place in time, right?
Yeah, because when you say unborn in relationship to the creation, that means it's not there.
Oh, if it's unborn in relationship to the creation, something that's never been born in the creation, that
yeah.
thing has not been there. But that's all within Maya.
Yeah, exactly.
Then the
but there's a double meaning, there's a double use in the word unborn, depending on what you apply it to.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. But conscious being is the, just like you try to imagine non-existence. You try to imagine
there's non-existence.
You try to doesn't imagine exist. Non-existence, and the only thing that's left is existent being. So you try, because to imagine non-existence, you have to pull everything that has name and form, you have to blot it all out. The only thing you can't blot out is yourself, is being itself. Right. Is that weird?
Well, there's a lot of people that want to chat with you. I think that's why.
Okay. Oh, yeah. And Jagadish also wants me to answer a question for him.
Okay, that's what.
What is the question? I'm trying to remember. Okay, Jagadish, tell me how to do this now. Presently, Dharma rules in my mind, and to act from Dharma is prominent, but there are desires that arise from the unconscious that my mind prefers, but they were not there. They are not a dharmic, but are necessary and unhelpful. The question is, how to deal with those desires that are not welcome, as they may not be a blessing to a dharmic life at all? Well, see, if you just get a little objective, you probably have so many thoughts that are not necessarily useful.
a lot of them.
Right? Or even desires and thoughts that are passing through the mind, that, like Swamiji has said things like, it's just the mind. My mind can do all kinds of funny things. You know, you don't have to take it seriously if you don't want to engage in that thought or in that desire. It's not a desire that you're interested in, then you don't have to. Mm-hmm. But you can't control what's coming in and going out of the mind. Like, you think of it like this. The amount of data that's pouring into your mind, the amount of experiences that are pouring into your mind, just from your experience in the world, is incredible. Mm-hmm. And those type of funny thoughts and funny things can be coming out of your mind. It doesn't make any difference. What makes it, what is dharma and adharma, has only to do with what you do with those thoughts and feelings. Like, when some weird thought passes through, you can say, wow, that was a weird thought, or you have a desire that you don't really want to act on. That's not really a desire, actually. It doesn't have any power. It's like a burnt seed. And so if it's not a desire that you want to go with, and it has some power, but there's, you have no reason, you have no idea why you're being impelled in that way. You know, what did I do in my past? Or why is such a desire arising that has some punch to it, you know? And then you think, all right, that desire is there. It's not something I want to act on. And so then you have to use discipline, because it has some sort of a, has some sort of a hold on you. You can pull it back and just be with yourself and say no to it. But that's not very, very often, actually. Most of the desires that arise are coming from somebody else, somebody you see that the Jones is doing something out here. But it's not your prarabdha. And so it doesn't have a real hold on you, not really. You know? And if it's something that is arising and there's nothing wrong with it, you can make a choice. There's nothing wrong with the desire in and of itself. What is wrong with the desire is, if I say the whole desire template, it's, I want this so I can be happy. That's the problem right there. If I can work on the desire to do something, but that desire isn't capturing me, like my ananda, my fullness is dependent on my doing that, then it doesn't make any difference. Why do you even bother? Do you want to do something? You do it. Unless it's adharmic, or it's stopping you from doing something, some responsibility you have. Otherwise, what's the problem with it? So there has to be a problem, and then if there's a problem with it, then you say no, because it's not in my best interest or in the best interest of other people. So then you have some inclination, you say no to it. And that requires discipline, but it's not fair to say, this thought shouldn't come. You just don't have that kind of control. This desire shouldn't come. You don't have that kind of control. You can do something with what comes. But Swamiji tells that story often about this man who was, this king, was balding. He's going bald. And so he sent a message out to all of his subjects that if anybody can solve this problem, you know, I'll let him marry my beautiful daughter, something like that. If he can, but if he comes and he can't do it, then he's finished. he's dead. And so only a few people took up the challenge. So there's one, but the one fellow came and she said, I definitely can solve this problem. I can definitely make your hair grow, your hair will grow in just a few days, there's that there will be no problem at all. But you have to do exactly what I say. So he says, take this potion, it'll take me a few days to make it, I'll give you the potion. And just make sure that before you take that, put that in your mouth, don't think of eggplant.
He's stuck.
And so then what would happen is every time he would try to take the potion, eggplant would come. So this, but if this is a real truism, so say you tell yourself, don't think of this. Then all your mind wants to do is think of it. Because the mind, another interesting thing about the mind, it doesn't have negatives. It doesn't know the difference between think about eggplant or don't think about eggplant.
It doesn't understand
the negative, And so it's not fair for you to try to control this very complex network of data that's coming through in terms of telling what can come through and what can't come through. It doesn't work. And so you have to be with what comes through in a way that doesn't compromise your shanti. You have to learn how to welcome these things and then act upon them in a way. That's a trick. Everybody's welcome, right? Everybody is welcome, but then what I do with you is another thing. And you're all welcome, all the thoughts are welcome, the feelings are welcome, but then I'm the one who handles them. Yeah.
Well, where should the emphasis of control be?
Say the action that is being, the desire that's impelling you is something that's not really helpful or useful, and it's causing a problem for you. Because a lot of things aren't helpful or necessarily useful. They're not a problem. So what difference does it make? Really? But if it is a problem, like having ice cream every night or something like that, that's not healthy and it'll make you gain weight and it's a problem, even though it's good and you really like it, that you say no. Because it's really not in your best interest. So then you have to say no. So you have to make that judgment. I certainly don't go around saying that everything that I do, is it helpful, is it useful? I don't care. It's only if it's a problem to myself or others, and then that presents itself. And then you have to make a decision. You have to say no because it's not really not in your best interest. And so sometimes that takes a little discipline or whatever, and then you have to work up to be able to say no to it because it's some sort of a sensory desire of sorts, whatever. But it's not in your best interest, so then you say no. But otherwise, if it's just neither here nor there, what difference does it make? I don't see any difference.
I don't know if this is what Jagadisha is asking, but some thoughts seem to be so disturbing or distracting, depending on what they are, that they seem to be, just by themselves, causing problems.
Here he says, thank you, but if those desires arise often, then somehow they gain importance. There's even clear knowledge that it is not to be fulfilled. So discipline should be used to neutralize the desire. You got a typo there, Jagadish, I'm not quite sure what you mean. There's even clear knowledge that it does not need to be fulfilled. So discipline should be used to neutralize the desire. There's even clear knowledge that it should not be fulfilled or something. If it's causing you a problem, then what I would do, if the desire is causing me a problem, then I would go into a dialogue with it. And you'd say, what is it that, what is it that we really want? Yeah. What do you really need, or what are you really looking for? So you can see, try to get to the part of yourself that's pushing for that desire, you know, or bringing it up again and again. Somebody's knocking on the door, you know, that wants some attention. That's what I would do, and then I would be with it, be with the one who's asking for that, and try to get to the little one inside, you know. And then by that way, I can get to the, get into a dialogue with who's really having the desire.
Well, could you just ignore that situation, or would?
Well, if you could, you would, but that's what he's saying. What if you can't? What if the desire keeps coming and coming? I would look at it, because it's not something you really want to do, I would look at who's knocking, who wants the attention. You know, somebody inside needs you. They need to, they're trying to communicate something with you. So you need to get to that one. And then hear that whole story. Be with that in, as an inner friend. It does not need to be fulfilled. If it doesn't need to be fulfilled, I don't think all desires do need to be fulfilled, but if you want to, then it just becomes a question of this, if there's something wrong with it. Mm-hmm. Just because you don't need to fulfill it doesn't mean that you shouldn't fulfill it. Or if it's part of your parabha, you could say, well, I don't really need to fulfill that, or I don't need to fulfill that. But then it's there to be fulfilled, and there's nothing wrong with it. That's the thing.
Well, desire by its nature is something that comes up that you want to do, otherwise you can't call it a desire.
Right, you want to.
So it's
to
a bit of a, it seems like it's a kind of a sophistry in a way to say, well, there's the desire coming up, but what if you don't want to fulfill it? It seems like that's what you said. See, but by its nature, it's something you want. That's why we call it desire.
Yes, but it can conflict with your dharma. See, a desire comes up, but there's a conflict.
Yeah.
And so then you want it because it's a desire.
You also don't want it.
But you also
dharma.
Don't want it because of dharma.
Yeah.
Right. And so then you have to pull back and say no. I mean, usually dharma comes first. That becomes a value. That should be my value, that dharma comes first. But then you might want to do some inner dialogue with the one who really wants to do this. This action, but if it's conflicting with your dharma, then dharma usually is the last word, especially in light of this knowledge. And also, you also know on another level that desires themselves are born of ignorance. What's born of ignorance is that I think that my ananda is out here, and I've realized that isn't true. And so that means that the strength that the desire has is already weakened. So I have, it's much easier for me to say no to a desire because they're not real to me, in the sense that I know that I'm the ananda, not the ananda doesn't exist in that object. And so then, if the desire is going against my dharma, or what is good or useful, I'll say no to it because there are problems with it. But what if the desire is just part of the prarabdha? Because the prarabdha fulfills itself either by people pulling you into a situation, or the universe has created, the society has created a situation that involves you, or coming through your own desires. That's what's impelling you in your prarabdha. And so I wouldn't look at desires as at all necessarily bad. They're the energy that make you move. But what makes them so binding is that this projection of ananda onto the object of desire, that's what makes them binding, you know, and painful. Because then if it's not fulfilled, then I'm upset. But for a jnani, you can have the energy to do something, but if it doesn't work out the way that you thought, that's fine. I did my best, or whatever. Because I am not projecting the ananda there. Does that make sense?
Yes, but it seems like we're redefining desire, because the spiritual world is... The esoteric spiritual world is loaded with teachings that desire is the number one enemy. I mean, that's throughout. And now we're saying that desire cannot really be a binding thing.
No, the thing is when you say desire is the number one enemy, you have to define it. And that's what I'm talking about, the desire template. It has to be, for desire to really be a desire, it has to be the full template, either positively or negatively. I want this so that I can be happy. Or I don't want this so that I can be happy. That's the desire template. If I have a desire, I want this thing because it'll make me whole, complete, happy. What if, for Jnani, that's no longer true?
Hmm.
Because my ananda isn't something that comes and goes, has nothing to do with the object.
So there's some impulse to act or some motive force or whatever you want to call it, but it's not hooked up with the ananda. That's
no.
The difference you're saying.
Yeah, it's a big, big difference.
Yeah,
it's a big difference. Because then when I realize that, then my wholeness or fullness or ananda is not dependent on fulfilling that desire. Mm-hmm. But I still might want to fulfill the desire. I have energy for it. But if it doesn't come out the way I want, it doesn't matter to me because that projection's not there. Or it's there in a non-binding way, in an unreal. It's not there in a binding way.
We can also look at our experience with desire and actually fulfilling desire and recognize that all fulfilled desires are only temporary. So if you don't get your desire, you're still going to be okay because you didn't really miss anything.
Yeah.
Liz has a question.
Because it didn't fulfill anything to begin with.
Yeah. And nothing really happened.
Right.
Yeah. That's right. That's true. Well, kind of facetiously is that, you know, like tennis players play tennis in their mind,
mm-hmm.
and they actually develop
mm-hmm.
those skills
mm-hmm.
by doing it mentally.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you imagine, I used it as a meditation, imagine biting into a lemon.
Mm-hmm.
But your mind doesn't really know the difference between physical reality and imaginal reality in some ways.
Right.
Yeah,
well, maybe by combining what I said and he said, you visualized, you did it, see the temporary happiness, then see the temporariness of the happiness, and it went away,
yeah.
and say, what was the whole worth of it? And then it becomes worthless to you, so then you can skip it.
Yeah, actually,
by
that's
doing
kind
a pre-play.
Yeah, it's kind of bringing your knowledge to bear.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially if something, you really want it, but there's obstructions and all kinds of things. There, you can really think it through and kind of reel your mind back in. You know, like, the ananda doesn't really exist there. So let me reel this back in and just, you know, see what happens.
Although if I really, really want something, imagining it just doesn't cut it. It's really not the same.
Yeah.
But I have a different question that might be quick. Are we...
Well, just a second.
Okay.
Good, Jagadish. I think that's good for now.
So, hot space?
Yeah,
I don't really know what you mean when you say that. I've been confused for...
Forever. Say if you have a pot.
Yeah.
And there's space in the pot. Like, say here. Like, here's the pot, and here's
uh-huh.
pot space, right? Or here,
okay.
in this cup. Here's a cup, and inside the cup, where it's holding the water, there's space in the cup. There's space outside the cup.
Okay.
And there's space in the cup.
Okay.
So now this would be cup space. Is the space in the cup. Right,
okay.
Like here's space outside of the cup, here's space in the cup. That's cup space.
The inside is.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't, by taking that drink, you didn't change cup space.
I didn't.
But the thought is, so, but the drishtanta is saying that...
What the illustration is saying is that if the cup is ignorant of its space, the cup says, I have pot space inside, cup spaces that are inside of me. This is my space. This is my space. This is your space. But this is my space, okay? And so now, as it moves along, it's taking its space with it. That's what it thinks.
And that's analogous to the confusion of thinking that
yourself is walking
the
anyonia, around.
Yes. Okay.
No, well, yeah. Say now you, with this body, mind, sense, organs, you walk across the room. Okay? Are you taking yourself with you? is yourself walking across the room. Your mind is walking across the room.
In your body.
In your body. Subtle body attached to this body is walking across the room, but it's the Atma walking. You say, no, the Atma is not walking. There's nothing but the Atma. There's no place for the Atma to walk because there's nothing but the Atma. Atma is non-dual. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I was just confused what pot space was. Because it's not real, it's an imaginary thing.
But that's the point.
Yeah.
It isn't real, but the pot can think it's real.
Mm-hmm.
The pot can think that the space belongs to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is actually moving that space along, but actually space is subtle and pervasive to the whole thing. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So space isn't moving. Of course, you're not space.
Mm-hmm.
Space has dimension and all of that, but the good thing about space as an example is that space is homogeneous and everything exists and in space. Space itself doesn't move.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no wall, there's no room space here really, that's an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
The space is pervasive to all the walls and everything. There's one as though all-encompassing space in which everything moves and exists, and space is more subtle. At least from our...
Objects do not display space.
Yes. Exactly. Walls don't displace it. Cups don't displace it. Everything exists in space, and space is more subtle than, according to our perceptual understanding.
I wanted to go back to the mind thing about what Jagadish brought up for a second.
Okay.
So, you said that that we can't really be in control of these things that come in and out.
You can't ask them not to come in.
Okay.
Once they've come, right?
At the moment that it is already come, you can't say, don't have come.
Yes, you can't say
okay,
that.
That's, yeah, it's present at the moment.
Yeah.
But it's not like if you're doing... You're practicing contemplations by Raga, you're achieving realizations, you're getting more shanti, that kind of experience will have you'll have a different mind in a few days or weeks or months than
yeah.
you did before. These things won't come as much. I mean,
they probably won't, but what if you were to say to the thought, to something, don't come.
Don't come anymore.
It's already come.
Okay, so you're talking about adding resistance to it.
Yeah.
Which just empowers it.
Yeah, or even to ask it, tell it not to come. In the very telling it not to come, you're bringing
right.
it with you. You know?
I thought you were kind of saying that mind training doesn't really work.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that.
Okay,
because
it
doing,
does, I think.
But what I'm saying is that you do mind training, or even you're doing meditation, the meditation is really bringing the act of bringing the mind back. Otherwise, you're in samadhi. Meditation is bringing the mind back. Okay, so that means that something's gone on, right? And so, say, a certain thoughts have come, now you have to work with those thoughts that have come. If the thoughts haven't come, there's nothing there to work with. It's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I think we should stop. I'm going to meet with somebody right now. So, are we okay to stop? Okay.